It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The goal with Special Needs Trust is we want to basically make these assets not accountable resource. Most of the need-based programs, the threshold's $2,000. They do vary, but essentially $2,000 is the threshold for most, such as SSI and Medicaid. And so our goal with Special Needs Trust is to set the assets up in a manner that will essentially allow them not to be countable assets. Whether it's $100,000 in the Special Needs Trust, I've got one that's got a couple million, it's still not countable. So that's the goal.
Estate planning attorney Mary Ellis talks about Special Needs Trusts at the 2013 annual statewide legal aid conference. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how the Health Marketplace Virginia proposal could reduce health coverage churn. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 234, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. As Virginia lawmakers continued to negotiate about expanding Medicaid health care coverage in Virginia, they have one more reason to support ideas like the Senate's bipartisan Marketplace Virginia proposal. New research shows how using private sector options to close the coverage gap, like the one being debated in Virginia, can be a key part of a solution to one of the biggest challenges in health insurance, abrupt changes in coverage called churning. Churning happens when a family's income changes enough that their access to health coverage changes too. Get a pay raise and you might no longer qualify for Medicaid. Lose some hours and there goes your tax credit to help pay for private health insurance in the federal marketplace. The result is you bounce or churn from one insurance carrier to another. These transitions can cause long gaps in coverage and disrupt continuous health care. Changes in coverage can force families to find new health care providers or change their current treatments based on what different insurance policies cover. These can be jarring disruptions that hurt families and weaken our health care system. This is a real problem, especially for people stuck in the coverage gap. States like Virginia suffer even more from this problem. The study found that states with less poverty have more churning because more of their residents hover right around the eligibility cutoffs for Medicaid or private health insurance tax credits and subsidies, rather than firmly below. Using federal funds to help people afford private health insurance coverage could be done in ways that would reduce these problems for families. If people could remain covered in private health plans regardless of whether their coverage came via a tax credit in the federal marketplace or a Marketplace Virginia-type approach, churning could be reduced. Ideas like Marketplace Virginia can reduce churning by up to two-thirds, especially in states with less generous Medicaid programs, previous research has shown. And only a handful of states make it harder to get Medicaid coverage than Virginia. Ideas like this also save Virginia money, close the coverage gap, leverage the private sector, and reduce churn. The House now needs to get on board and quickly. Otherwise, Virginians stuck in the coverage gap will be left to churn in the wind. For more information, go to www.thecommonwealthinstitute.org. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. It's time for this week's question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Would you please tell us your name and where you're from?
Ken from Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome to the show. Ken, what question do we have this week?
I want to know if I'm responsible for payment of bed bug treatment, which I did not create.
Well, Ken, we get that question a lot. And the answer is absolutely not. You are not responsible for the cost of bedbug treatment, and indeed, there is no legal authority that allows a landlord to require a tenant to pay for the cost of bedbug treatment. The reason I'm so confident in saying this is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development studied the whole bedbug problem very carefully. They issued a 7-page memo. It says that bedbugs can be introduced to a property simply by hitchhiking on clothing and can be introduced by the landlord themselves or their employees or maintenance personnel or contractors or vendors or government representatives or really anyone who has had access to the property. No one's immune from transporting bed bugs. They are not linked to poor sanitation or poor housekeeping, and the conclusion of HUD is that it is virtually impossible to prove fault with regard to who may have created the bed bug infestation within a property. What they conclude from that is that residents should not bear the burden regarding the introduction of bedbugs to a property, and that landlords should be reasonable and should not penalize tenants because they have discovered and reported bedbugs within their unit. What landlords should do is when tenants report they have bedbugs, the landlord should inspect, confirm that the pest is a bedbug, and if so, immediately treat not only that unit, but all of the surrounding units. Because it's not normally considered an emergency, the tenants should receive at least a 2-day notice before inspection and treatment, and only if advised by a qualified pest control professional should landlords notify tenants that they should dispose of furnishings. And this should only be done as a last resort, not as a first resort. Finally, HUD concludes that bedbug infestation is not grounds for termination of tenancy. In other words, it's not the tenant's fault. The Virginia Residential Landlord-Tenant Act makes it clear that routine maintenance and repairs and keeping the place habitable is the responsibility of the landlord. It is not the responsibility of the tenant. Is this helpful to you?
Yes, it is. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being on the show. If someone is receiving any form of needs-based benefits or disability benefits from the Social Security Administration, they may require a special needs trust. Estate planning attorney Mary Ellis spoke about special needs trusts at the 2013 annual statewide Legal Aid Conference, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here are her comments.
I'm Mary Ellis. I'm with Bordeaux Bone and Ellis. I have an estate planning practice that focuses quite a bit on special needs planning. Today I was going to cover special needs trust, and then if we have time, hit some other things with guardianship and some other special needs planning. You know, special needs trust deals with what we want to do first is identify, do we need to even think about a special needs trust? And there's really two categories of individuals that may require special needs trust. The first category will be an individual who either is receiving or is likely to receive Section 8 housing, Medicaid, SSI, or any type of need-based program or benefit. The other thing to look at is, even if an individual isn't currently receiving those types of benefits, are they an individual that the Social Security Administration has found to be deemed a disabled person for purposes of Social Security Administration? If that's the case, then we are looking at special needs trusts. The goal with special needs trust is we want to basically make these assets not accountable resource. Most of the need-based programs, the threshold's $2,000. They do vary, but essentially $2,000 is the threshold for most, such as SSI and Medicaid. And so our goal with special needs trust is to set the assets up in a manner that will essentially allow them not to be countable assets. Whether they're it's $100,000 in the special needs trust, I've got one that's got a couple million, it's still not countable. So that's the goal. You know, special needs trust before the Reconciliation Act of 1993 were really non-existent. Before that, we always had to do like moral trust, where we would leave assets to a different family member or friend, or gift money to family members or friends and say, look, can you take care of our special needs loved one? Problem with that was that sometimes that special needs individual didn't ever got the money. And then also what sometimes happened is the individual had good intentions, but they caused a wreck, got sued, had creditor issues, got a divorce, things of that nature. So it didn't really work. And then, of course, the worst option was is just to completely exclude the special needs individual, which essentially meant they had nothing. So fortunately, in 1993, Congress came up under the Omnibus Budget and Reconciliation Act of 1993 some special needs trust options. And essentially, when we talk about special needs trust, we're talking about three different types. One is what's called a third-party funded, which means it's being set up with third-party money. It does not the money of the special needs individual. That's what's called a third-party funded special needs trust. The other two type of special needs trusts are for essentially the individual's own assets. The special needs individual has received money either because of Social Security payback, a gift or inheritance that wasn't structured correctly, personal injury settlement, lottery. We've had some lottery winners. Anyone like that, we want to get that money out of their name and into a special needs trust, which I'll go into more detail. Am I speaking too quickly? Because I was a debater, so I sometimes get carried away. So if I do, just raise your hand and say. The first, basically the special needs trust, the money is put into a trust fund, and I'll go over the different ways to set that up. But we essentially put them in the trust fund, and they operate under what's called a special needs standard or supplemental needs standard, which means it can't pay for the basic things that are covered by SSI, Section 8 housing, and Medicaid. Some of the things it can pay for are, you know, special furniture, furniture for the home, medical and health care costs that are not covered by Medicaid. That can be supplemental health insurance. That can be durable medical equipment. Can be a special van. Really anything the special needs individual needs that's not covered by any of the government programs. We also have used money from special needs trust for summer camps, entertainment, you know, tickets, traveling companions, as well as sporting equipment, computer, haircuts, really just anything other than shelter and the very basic needs that are supposed to be covered by Section 8 housing, Medicaid, and or SSI. We also can pay for pets, pet care. Those are some of the things. The first type of special needs trust I was going to talk about is what's called the third-party funded. What that means is that someone either has left money to a special needs individual in a special needs trust, or they want to start giving money to a special needs individual. And so what we do is we set up what's called a special needs trust third-party funded. What that means is we either set it up in a separate trust agreement, we set it up in a will, and essentially it provides that anything in the trust is to be used for the special needs individual, subject to that special needs standard. You do appoint a trustee. There are some different options. There are professional trustees out there. Sometimes people will also pick family members or friends. Disadvantage to family members or friends is they don't have the expertise. And you do one of the burdens or one of the things that a special needs trustee does have to do is make sure all the expenditures are correct. That they're not, there's no expenditure that's going to basically make the trust not a qualified special needs trust. Because if that happens, then the individual is going to be treated as if they have everything in that special needs trust. And that's what we want to avoid. So you always want to make sure you have a trustee that's sophisticated to that and sensitive to that. I do have sample language in terms of special needs standard that people are happy to, or welcome to grab later. It essentially says anything that's not going to affect benefits. Anything that's not going to affect eligibility, the trust can be used for. Sometimes that's a moving target, which is why it's so loosely worded. One thing we also do with the special needs trust, we always have a merger provision. And the reason we put that in there is because special needs individuals have varying degrees of abilities and limitations, and they often change as time goes on. And so in a special needs trust, we will always have a provision that would allow the trust to be merged into a non-special needs trust so that if the individuals become very self-sufficient, doesn't need any of the benefits, then we can merge it into more of a traditional support trust, health support maintenance, like we do for minor children. With a third-party special needs trust, when you're dealing with someone else's money, whether it's by gift or inheritance, when that special needs individual passes away, it goes to whomever the donor, the person who set up the trust, says it goes to. It can be family members, friends, charities, whomever they want. They can leave it to whomever they want once that beneficiary has passed away. We also can give the beneficiary what's called a limited power of appointment, which essentially the special needs beneficiary can say, I want this to go to a certain class of people. Generally, it's descendants, spouses, family members. So we are allowed to do that. One of the things we've been running into increasingly are special needs trusts that are not correctly worded. They don't qualify as a special needs trust. And so fortunately, with Virginia's adoption of the Uniform Trust Code, we're able to actually basically revise those and make them valid special needs trust. You essentially get the beneficiaries of the trust to agree. We want it to be a special needs trust. And then we submit it to the court for approval. And so that's really allowed us to protect a lot of special needs individuals where we used to have to, there wasn't much we could do other than to do a formal court petition. So we've been able to that's really helped us a lot with that. Another thing, if people don't want to do a private special needs trust, is Commonwealth Community Trust. It's a nonprofit that operates out of Richmond. And all it does is operate special needs trust. It operates the third-party funded like we're talking about now, and then it also operates what we call self-funded, which I'll talk about later. But it's a nonprofit. The key to them is their fees are very low because, again, they're a nonprofit. And probably the biggest benefit is that they have the expertise because all they do are special needs trust. So that's becoming increasingly popular for attorneys and families is to look at Commonwealth Community Trust. Another benefit of Commonwealth Community Trust is that instead of having each trust individually, they invest everything together. So you get a much greater return. Right now, they've got about $24 million. And so when you invest that, you get a much better return than when clients $50,000, $10,000, or $100,000.
You've been listening to estate planning attorney Mary Ellis talking about special needs trusts at the 2013 annual statewide legal aid conference of Virginia Legal Aid Attorneys. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of Mary Ellis, an estate planning attorney, talking about special needs trusts at the 2013 annual statewide legal aid conference.
The second type of special needs trust is what's called self-settled, and that's usually the big one. That's when we're dealing with the special needs individual's actual money. Like I said, they've gotten it from inheritance, a gift, the attorney didn't draft it correctly, or they won the lottery, personal injury settlement, a lot of Social Security payback will come in. It'll be a lump sum that's going to get them over that $2,000. And with that type of trust, there's really two types. There's what's called the D4A Special Needs Trust, and that's also under the Omnibus Act of 1993. Essentially, that trust is a separate trust agreement. It does have to be set up by the disabled person's parent, the grandparent, their legal guardian, or the court. The disabled individual themselves can't set it up, can't be set up by a power of attorney. So that's one of the limitations. If the person doesn't have a living parent, grandparent, or have a guardian, then sometimes we'll petition the court and ask the court to set it up. But the distribution terms are the same, supplement government benefits, pay for those extras, and don't affect eligibility. You know, the key is to make sure the trust assets are not a countable resource. In terms of termination, the special needs trust ends when the special needs person passes away. And then at that point, this is a little bit different because it's the special needs individual's money. We have to reimburse Medicaid for what's been paid under the Medicaid plan. Some people refer to it as a Medicaid payback trust. Again, the difference is when that special needs individual passes away, we pay back anything Medicaid paid on their behalf over their lifetime. As a general rule, that consumes most of the trust assets, unless the trust is very large. There is still a provision, if there is money left after the payback, that it goes to whomever the trust agreement says, and that can be family members, friends, charities, you know, whomever set it up can leave it to wherever they want. The other type of self-settled special needs trust is a pooled trust. It's under D4C of OBRA, 1993. Essentially, it has to be held and operated by a nonprofit organization. Commonwealth Community Trusts, again, in Virginia, is the one that does it. A lot of states have them. But basically, the nonprofit operates it as a special needs trust. Again, you get the key with that is that that can be set up by the parent, the guardian, grandparent, and the court, but that can also be set up by the special needs individual. So we use that a lot. If it's a special needs individual that is not legally incapacitated, then we get them to actually sign the trust agreement with pooled trust and set it up. Distribution standard is the same. We're going to supplement. We don't want to do anything that's going to make the trust assets accountable resource. So again, it's the same distribution standard. As with the D4A trust, as soon as the special needs individual passes away, the trust terminates, Medicaid's repaid, and then normally Medicaid, once Medicaid's repaid, whatever's left then goes to the nonprofit, although most nonprofits as well as Commonwealth Community Trusts allow a termination fee to be paid, and then the balance goes to whomever the family's written in the trust instrument. And again, those are the two big issues is whose money is it? If it's the special needs individual, we're going to have the Medicaid payback. If it's not the special needs individual, then when that person dies, we can have it go wherever we want. One of the things we also run into, as I said, is that these trusts, especially the self-settled, whether it's actually the special needs individual's money, can only be set up by certain parties. And so a lot of times what will happen is we'll get a personal injury settlement, a lottery winning, Social Security payback, but there's no one to sign the paperwork. There's no parent. There's no grandparent. The court doesn't want to get into it, although the courts are getting pretty good about that. And so what we have to do is get a guardian and a conservator appointed for the special needs individual. Here in Virginia, it would be the conservator, which is in charge of financial matters. And then essentially what that process involves is that you petition the circuit court. You allege this is an individual that's special needs, they need assistance with financial matters, and as a result of that, in needing this help, we want a guardian and conservator appointed. The conservator, sometimes what we'll do, if it's an individual, especially with like mental health issues, where sometimes there's total capacity and sometimes there's total incapacity, we'll do an appointment for conservator for a set period of time, 90 days, 6 months, just to allow us to get the special needs trust signed off and entered. So that's one thing we can do too. Again, the timing's the big thing. We always try to get everything in place before we accept the money when it's the special needs individual's own money. With the guardianship and conservatorship, the courts have gotten really good about letting us really modify the order. It used to be if someone had a guardian and conservator, they were completely incapacitated and couldn't do anything. Virginia now allows us to do limited conservatorships where we can limit it by time, like I said, 60 days, 30 days, 90 days, just to get all the paperwork in place for the special needs trust. We also can limit it to just that activity. It can be that it's to help them get a divorce, get an equitable distribution, help them set up things such as that. So it's a real common tool that we use as part of the special needs trust and part of the special needs planning. With the guardian and conservator, we also can do even more involved estate planning. This is going to come into play more where we've got a married couple and we're worried about eligibility for Medicaid. But the guardianship and conservatorship is an excellent tool from basically allowing someone to make those decisions, divest people of assets, put them into the special needs trust. I have found with the special needs trust that the Department of Social Services, they're all starting to really catch up and get a real understanding of special needs trusts and how they work. Once you have the special needs trust, you can always get DMAS and or social services to take a look at it and make sure that, you know, here's the plan, here's the trust agreement, here's how we plan to fund it, and get their approval before you actually put everything into play. And we do that quite a bit. Not so much in Virginia now because they're pretty comfortable, but sometimes we'll have clients that are getting money out of state. I've got one pending right now with Alabama, where we just say, here's a special needs trust, here's the language, here's what we're planning on doing, is it okay? So that way you don't ever risk making the person ineligible at any time. So that's gotten to be a real common tool.
You've been listening to estate planning attorney Mary Ellis speaking about special needs trusts at the 2013 annual statewide legal aid conference. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. You've seen the ads. Stop foreclosures, garnishments, lawsuits, repossessions, and collector calls. But will bankruptcy do all that? Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when bankruptcy attorney Andrew Chen explains what bankruptcy can and cannot do. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.